This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff, and lucky me, the University of Virginia Press sent me an advanced copy of this big, beautiful book called Mapping Virginia, the insides of which present a cartographic feast of Virginia from her place as a twinkle in the eye of the world's great explorers through the Civil War. The book is taken from the collection of Bill Wooldridge of Suffolk, Virginia. So, of course, I asked Bill what in the world drove him to collect so many historical maps of Virginia.
Well, it's quite a story. I collected antique maps of Virginia for 40 years, and when it finally came time to dispose of them, a local group in Tidewater wanted to keep the collection together, keep it in Tidewater rather than see it dispersed to the winds. So they bought it, lock, stock, and barrel. And part of the deal was that they wanted an account of these maps that would provide some context for them so that they wouldn't just be physical objects. They would be pieces of history. And what was that history? So I agreed to provide that account. And one thing led to another. We were working with the Mariners Museum. The Mariners Museum was working with the University of Virginia Press. And so this account of the maps in my collection over a period of about 3 years turned in to this book, which, as you say, UVA Press did a gorgeous job of producing. It is as fine a quality a cartographic history as I've seen coming from anywhere.
Why maps first, and then why maps of Virginia for you?
Well, there are two or three parts or answers to that question. I think collecting is an instinct. Some people collect matchbooks. Some people collect bottle caps. I collected stamps when I was a kid. I was a very enthusiastic stamp collector. It's a pastime that seems to have gone out of vogue. But I was also always a history buff. So I got a little older, and I discovered, actually, while my wife and I were active duty in Germany with the Army, and I walked by a little store in Heidelberg that had, of all things, a tiny 17th century map of Virginia in the shop window. So I bought it really just as a souvenir. I wasn't a collector at that point. And then within a year or so, I bought another one and a third one. And by the time you get to three, if you have that collecting bug, you're gone. You're down the river. So I was launched onto 40 years of collecting maps. Virginia maps, because I'm from Virginia. I was always interested in Virginia history and maps as opposed to bottle cap covers or more stamps, because they do have so much to say about our history. And on top of that, it's like an added free bonus. Some of them are just exquisitely beautiful works of art. As you can see, you don't even have to open this book. You look at the cover and you can tell what a treat you're in store for.
You're a lifelong Virginian. And you've been deeply involved with Virginia history. I was just taking a peek again at your little mini bio here, and you've served as president of the John Marshall Foundation and the Norfolk Historical Society, and chair of the Map Support Group of the Library of Virginia. So where does this deep interest in history come from, do you think?
Well, that's a tough question. My father was a career naval officer, and we grew up. He was from Virginia, and we came back to Virginia when he retired. But we grew up moving all over the country, and I was always interested in the old things that we saw. I remember about seven or 8 years old, going to Fort Laramie. Well, it was all cowboys and Indians to me at that stage, but still, that's history. And I think the stories of history, the sense of gaining an understanding of where you come from and why you are or why we are as a society the way we are, is illuminated by history. And that sounds a little cliched, but there are a lot of us history buffs around, and we'd probably explain it the same way.
You've been so active in these historical societies. You're working to make history present in our lives. Why?
We need to, first of all, preserve the physical artifacts of our past, such as these maps, which are literally pictures of our past, pictures of our history over the centuries, how that history and that geography was understood over the centuries. The John Marshall Foundation was involved with preserving the John Marshall House. The map support groups at the Library of Virginia and the Library of Congress that helped support those artifacts or collect and preservation of those artifacts. Virginia Historical Society, of course, it does a lot of things, but preserving the physical mementos of what's gone before is among them. But along with preserving those mementos is preserving the memories, the heritage, the sense of evolution and of becoming what we are, for better and for worse, but at least understanding it, not being blind about it, and having some sense of where we might be able to go on the basis of that history, of that path.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
May I ask what you did to earn a living while you were collecting maps?
Yes, my day job, which was entirely satisfactory in its own right, was as an attorney. And my entire career was spent first with the Norfolk and Western Railroad, and then after we merged with the Southern Railroad in 1982 with Norfolk Southern, which was the resulting company. So except for a few years in Army JAG, I was a railroad lawyer.
Railroads always, to me, seem part and parcel of America's history.
Absolutely. You know? And it's doubly true in the legal arena, because our whole structure of corporate law, regulatory law, securities law, it all has its roots in railroad history. And you can be, I'm convinced, a better corporate lawyer if you understand that history. Maybe that's a more specific answer to your question, you know, why study any kind of history, is because when you get your hands on those roots, you know why things are the way they are.
That's really interesting. I'm going to spend some time thinking about what you just said about the railroad history being a big history of why we are legally the way we are. Mm-hmm. But going back to maps, what did you learn from collecting maps about Virginia history that you might have missed?
There are two or three things that stand out and that I have tried to highlight in the book. First of all, is the really radically changing notions of what Virginia is, what Virginia meant, where it was. And this came to me in a sort of a backwards way. I thought I was collecting maps of Virginia, and generally that meant a map that said Virginia up at the top, but they were maps of all different places. I mean, the geography was very inconsistent. But after you accumulate enough of them and study enough of them, you can start to put together the story that I tell here of the evolution of the idea of Virginia from one generation to the next, starting out as this amorphous, unbounded, mysterious wilderness on the eastern coast of North America. This is the Virginia of the lost colony. It's a Virginia that is seen as an Eden, or potentially an Eden. And as the illustrations in the book show, actually the first map to be called a map of Virginia was accompanied by a picture of Adam and Eve, because they were thinking of this place as a new Eden, or as at least
that,
having Edenic characteristics. And then from that, you proceed to a wholly different notion of Virginia, which is the area around Chesapeake Bay and extending westerly toward the mountains. This idea of Virginia was given definition by the most famous of all Virginia map makers, Captain John Smith. Everybody knows about Captain John Smith. Well, why did he have this particular notion of Virginia instead of the universally acknowledged idea of Virginia up until that time of most of eastern North America? And I don't make these generalizations lightly. I make them on the basis of what we see in these individual
maps,
all of which are illustrated in the book. I would say that one of the nice things the press did, all 300 maps that are discussed are illustrated. So Captain John Smith, it turns out, was dealing with the area controlled by King Powhatan. And he was essentially mapping Powhatan's kingdom. The name of it was Senecomica. He thought that the English would achieve a conquest of this kingdom, just as the Spanish had conquered the Aztec kingdom or the kingdom of Peru. They would be the new sovereigns, and that was his Virginia.
I wish I was a trapper. I would give a thousand pelts to sleep with Pocahontas and find out how she felt in the morning on the fields of green.
Well, that's just the first two steps of the process. It goes on and on. Virginia extends conceptually to the Pacific. The charter bounds go to the Pacific. It extends not just conceptually, but in reality, in very important political ways, into the old Northwest Territory. That's the area north and west of the Ohio River, what we think of as the Midwest now. But that was Virginia, and it's mapped as Virginia. Now, I'm not saying that these things are unknown, but I'm saying that you see them much more clearly and precisely and definitively through a study of the maps than you would in any other way.
It's sort of reliving history, isn't it, to look at a map of a contemporary map of a certain period?
Yes, it is. You are crawling inside the mind of the person who created the map, and by extension, probably the customers of the publishers of the maps, because they were in business. They wanted to sell these things, so they were creating maps that would appeal to their customers. And it's sort of like a reverse Rorschach test. I mean, instead of looking at the ink blot and seeing what you see, you look at what they drew as Virginia, what they highlighted, what they emphasized. For example, there will be maps where the Indians are the most important thing. They're illustrated in great detail, great exoticism. There are others. I don't know that there are any dragons on these maps, but there are plenty of sea monsters and other odd representatives of the animal world. So there's this sense of the wonder and mystery of Virginia. You come on down. Well, to skip to the very end, the book goes down through the Civil War, and you look at Civil War maps, and you see these are not just simple representations of the geography of Virginia or parts of Virginia. They are interpretations of the way people were thinking about the war, about Virginia's place in the war, and the connection to Virginia geography.
Bill Wooldridge, who's turned his enormous collection of historical Virginia maps into a feast of a book called, appropriately, Mapping Virginia, acquired his first Virginia map 40-some years ago in Germany. He and I sat down with the book and took a look. It's a wonderful book. First of all, it's got such heft.
6 pounds and 4 ounces, I think.
It's such, so you can use it to lift weights to do your curls with. And it is such a visual treat. I wonder if you would pick a couple of maps that were yours and tell the story of how you found those maps and then just talk about them.
Okay.
Take your time.
Be delighted. I will open the book, and let's start with some of the really most beautiful maps. Look at the John White map on page 11.
I am going to page 11.
Okay, now just to set the stage, this is a map that was printed in 1590. It was based on the explorations sent out by Sir Walter Raleigh that culminated in what we remember as the Lost Colony. At first, it looks a little unfamiliar, but if you rotate it 90 degrees to the left, it is a very accurate representation of the Outer Banks of North Carolina. In fact, it is said to be the most accurate map of any part of America made in the 16th century. It has incredibly lovely color, and this is not something that was applied last week. The map was issued, some copies of it were issued with this kind of color. And to tell you the story of how it came into this collection, there is an annual assemblage of map collectors, map dealers, curators of maps in libraries in Miami. It's called the Miami Map Fair. It's held generally the first week of February, and it has been a great success, not least because this business, a lot of it is in New York, and everybody is just delighted to go to Miami in February. The map dealers save up their better items to offer at the map fair. So I was at the Miami Map Fair a few years ago, and one of the dealers I've dealt with for many years, Henry Tolliver, I'm walking by his booth, and he says, "Sst, let me show you what I've got." So he reaches under his table, and he's pulling it out like somebody selling dirty postcards from his overcoat in Paris, and he pulls out this thing. Well, this is the Wiffley edition, the first edition of these maps and engravings of Virginia with original color. You see on the next page the Adam and Eve that I had mentioned previously. So this book came along at a time when printing had supplanted manuscript illumination, and the manuscript illuminators were unemployed. And at least some of them moved over into coloring prints, such as this map. And so that explains, you know, this is not just slopped on color. This is done with the precision of an illuminated manuscript. Well, Henry could see my eyes getting bigger and bigger, and I could see his hands just practically rubbing in glee because he knew he had set the hook. And we discussed it for a little while and agreed on a price, and I acquired the item. And to make a long story short, we all went out to a dinner that night and celebrated. So there's a little bit of everything there. There's the thrill of the quest. There's the thrill of discovery. There's the negotiations, which was probably my weakest suit, because when I saw one of these things, I generally wanted to acquire it. And the dealers pretty soon came to understand that, although it did have the effect of when something remarkable came to light in the market, it was often offered to me. So one reason this collection is as comprehensive as it is. All of that, plus the history and the geography and the art, and we're just looking at one map here. There's 300 of these in the book.
I like that you all went out to dinner to celebrate together, both offerer and purchaser. I think that's lovely. It's as though the map had gone where it should be, and we're all celebrating.
Yes, and Henry paid for dinner as well he might.
It's supper time. Yes, it's supper time. Oh, it's supper time. Very best time of day.
Where is the map that started it all?
It's not a particularly striking map, but if you look on page 41, at the bottom of the page, that little map is a tiny Dutch copy of the John Smith map. The John Smith map itself, the original John Smith map, was not widely circulated for quite a long time. It came out in England in 1612, but the Dutch were the real publishers and map makers in that period. So it wasn't until the Dutch got a hold of it and started making copies of it that the John Smith version of Virginia became more widely known in continental Europe. The big, what we call double folio copies, were quite expensive. Ordinary people couldn't buy them. But the map was reduced and sold in smaller atlases. They were called minor Mercators. Mercator was dead, but people respected his name. Minor meant a small Mercator. So here was the John Smith map reduced for inclusion in a minor Mercator atlas, and they sold like hotcakes, which means that there are quite a few copies of them left. So I was able to buy this map, as you say, the first map that I acquired in the course of becoming a map collector, for the equivalent of about $30 in Germany.
Now, let me ask you this. You just reeled off the history of this small-sized copy of a very famous map. How much of that history did you know when you bought it?
I knew none whatsoever. I was operating completely in the dark. All I knew was is that it said Virginia, and it was supposed to be old, and it turned out to be old. But in my lack of knowledge, or almost naivete, I had a fascination with the idea that you could actually own something that was 300 years old and that portrayed Virginia as people understood it 300 years ago.
How did you go about educating yourself about the history, not just the history of Virginia, but the history of Virginia's maps, to the point where you can write this book and reel off what you just reeled off?
Well, it's a long and a building process. You read what's in print. You follow dealer catalogs to see what they have to say. To some extent, auction catalogs. You get with curators whose business it is to know these things. I was particularly fortunate in being close to Colonial Williamsburg, where the curator was a woman named Margaret Pritchard, well, still is. Margaret Pritchard is the curator of maps there. So I had the benefit of her knowledge of the incredible Colonial Williamsburg map collection. There were people at the Library of Virginia. Marianne McKee was the map expert there. Number of people at the Library of Congress. You go to meetings, like I mentioned, the Miami Map Fair. You join organizations. You read the periodical literature. There's a magazine called The Portolan coming out of Washington, D.C. that is about antique maps. And you don't just learn something and put it in your pocket. You learn or notice or pick up something, and you go back and look at the maps, and that gives you a comprehension of something that's on the map that you hadn't noticed before, and you add that to what you've learned, and that, you know, it's a back and forth kind of process.
So you both learned from what you bought and bought because you had learned.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's an iterative, cumulative building process rather than a matter of learning a multiplication table where once you know 6 times 6 is 36, that's the end of it. That's not the way it is with maps.
Is there another map that you just kind of, in here, that you just kind of, besides the first one, that you just kind of fell over, you know, found in a yard sale or an antique shop?
Well, I'm going to turn, because it has a wonderful story.
Okay.
To the first map in the Civil War chapter, which is the last chapter in the book.
Okay. I must say, the colors in these maps, this may be an odd thing to say, but you could live in a house so peacefully and happily that was decorated with the colors in these maps.
I need to get you to talk to my wife, because she lived in such a house, not altogether contentedly for many years. My wife actually is a great supporter of the collection, but she didn't see it as art in quite the way that I did.
Marriage is compromise.
So I'm looking at a map that is shown on page 254 and 255.
All right.
It is what?
Oh,
at,
wow.
At the outbreak of the Civil War, this was the best map of Virginia. It was the official map of the state. It had come out in 1859, and it wasn't at all an adequate map, but it was the only usable map there was, or at least the best usable map there was. So both sides at the beginning of the Civil War tried to get their hands on copies of this map. And this particular copy has an interesting history. Well, there are two histories here, the history of the map and the history of how I acquired it.
Lay it on us.
The map belonged to a Confederate general, General Robert Selden Garnett. He was sent in the early days of the Civil War to defend what was then the western counties of Virginia. It's now West Virginia. He came up against General McClellan before anybody knew who General McClellan was, and was soundly defeated. He was retreating from West Virginia. Well, this had a lot of military significance and political significance, too, because the expulsion of the Confederates from the western Virginia counties was what made it possible to create the state of West Virginia. But in any event, McClellan's troops, specifically Major Benham, caught up with Garnett on his retreat, and Garnett was killed. Major Benham took this map from Garnett's body, and Garnett was the first general on either side in the Civil War to be killed. Benham took this map and wrote on it the inscription, which you see enlarged on page 255. He talks about the battle and date and place where he captured the map.
So this map in your book that you owned is that map.
It is that very map.
Please go on. I didn't want it to be. I was agog there for a minute.
This map was initially offered to me by a very fine California dealer at what I thought was an extravagant price. Map collecting has focused on the 17th and 18th century. 19th century maps like this, although they've certainly come on into their own in the last few years, they were not as aggressively collected, and consequently, the values were lower. The price on this was more like it had been signed by Captain John Smith instead of by Major Benham. And besides, I was a little hesitant because what's to keep somebody from taking just any copy of this map and writing an inscription on it like that? It brought to mind my wife and I were in England one time, and I bought what's called a Bible box. It's a sort of a chest that had a date on the front of it of 1677. And my wife said that if I hadn't been in such a big hurry, could have given the guy a little longer, I could have had 1492. And that's the issue with a map like this. So I passed it up. Well, it was acquired by a very fine Virginia dealer named Luke Vavra outside of Richmond, who did the real research on it, the spade work. And he was able to find an account by Major Benham published in an obscure 19th century periodical, in which he actually describes the map, and that legitimized it. That additional evidence made it clear that such this was that map. So I eventually was able to get it from Luke for an even more elevated price.
But you knew what you were getting.
I knew what I was getting. I knew it was right, and it is a remarkable piece of history. As you can see, it's not the most beautiful map in the book because by the 19th century we don't have all the flourishes that we do in 16th and 17th, but it does tell a very important story. And a footnote to that story, or maybe more than a footnote, is that McClellan's success in these Western Virginia campaigns was what led to his appointment as commander of the Army of the Potomac. He had been a nobody and unknown until that time. This brought him into prominence and led to his elevation.
And this map was part of that.
This map was at the very center of that. It was the killing of General Garnett that was the feather in the cap of Benham and McClellan in that campaign. Of course, all the maps are essentially portrayals of some kind of geography, but there's always a message besides the geography.
Yep.
And I've actually even tried to index that idea, but I will turn to one example in the Revolutionary War chapter. Yes, page 170.
All right.
So we all know about the Battle of Yorktown and the French participation with George Washington in compelling the surrender of Lord Cornwallis at Yorktown. And it was in large part because the French fleet was there and was able to keep the British fleet from assisting Cornwallis. This is a French map portraying that, but look how it's portrayed. You see those giant French ships lined up between Cape Henry and Cape Charles. Man, they are the leviathans of the ocean. Of course, the ships are wholly out of scale. The ships are not nearly that.
Yes, they're as big as Norfolk.
Right, exactly. And furthermore, they never actually took that position. I mean, you see them lined up there like a chain across the entrance to the Chesapeake Bay. Well, this is a little bit of chest thumping on the part of the French, their understanding of their contribution to the victory at Yorktown. And it's true, but it's not true at the same time. The map is exaggerated. The map on the following page, 172, which is an English map, gives you a much better sense of the actual movements of the fleets. But this French map is so exuberant and so enthusiastic and so exaggerated to make its point. And that phenomenon occurs over and over with these maps. I mean, I could go through here, I could put my fingers on a dozen maps where there's something not quite normal or right because the cartographer is selling a point of view.
You'll find links and images of the maps Bill and I talked about on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
do do.